gazing up the road in the direction of Hazel's Wood. Many times I wanted to ask him what the trouble was, and had I done so, I'm sure he would have told me at once. In any event, I knew that sooner or later I would hear all about it. I hadn't long to wait. About 10 days after his return from hospital, the two of us were sitting out on the platform of the caravan, watching the sun go down behind the big trees on the top of the hill across the valley. We had had our supper, but it wasn't my bedtime yet. The September evening was warm and beautiful and very still. "You know what makes me so hopping mad?" he said to me all of a sudden. "I get up in the mornings feeling pretty good. Then, about 9 o'clock every single day of the week, that huge silver Rolls-Royce comes swishing past the filling station, and I see the great big bloated face of Mr. Victor Hazel behind the wheel. I always see it. I can't help it. And, as he passes by, he always turns his head in my direction and looks at me. But it's the way he looks at me that is so infuriating. There is a sneer under his nose and a smug little smirk around his mouth, and although I only see him for 3 seconds, it makes me madder than mackerel. What's more, I stay mad for the rest of the day." "I don't blame you," I said. A silence fell between us. I waited to see what was coming next. "I'll tell you something interesting," he said at last. "The shooting season for pheasants starts on Saturday. Did you know that?"
"No, Dad, I didn't."
"It always starts on the 1st of October," he said. "And every year, Mr. Hazel celebrates the occasion by giving a grand opening day shooting party." I wondered what this had to do with my father being madder than a mackerel, but I knew for certain there would be a connection somewhere. "It is a very famous event, Danny, that shooting party of Mr. Hazel's."
"Do lots of people come?" I asked.
"Hundreds," he said. "They come from miles around. Dukes and lords, barons and baronets, wealthy businessmen and all the fancy folk in the county. They come with their guns and their dogs and their wives, and all day long the noise of shooting rolls across the valley. But they don't come because they like Mr. Hazel. Secretly, they all despise him. They think he's a nasty piece of work."
"Then why do they come, Dad?"
"Because it's the best pheasant shoot in the south of England. That's why they come. But to Mr. Hazel, it is the greatest day in the year, and he is willing to pay almost anything to make it a success. He spends a fortune on those pheasants. Each summer, he buys hundreds of young birds from the pheasant farm and puts them in the wood, where the keepers feed them and guard them and fatten them up, ready for the great day to arrive. Do you know, Danny, that the cost of rearing and keeping one single pheasant up to the time when it's ready to be shot is equal to the price of 100 loaves of bread?"
"It's not true."
"I swear it," my father said. "But to Mr. Hazel, it's worth every penny of it. And do you know why? It makes him feel important. For one day in the year, he becomes a big cheese in a little world. And even the Duke of so-and-so slaps him on the back and tries to remember his first name when he says goodbye." My father reached out a hand and scratched the hard plaster just below his left knee. "It itches," he said. "The skin itches underneath the plaster. So I scratch the plaster and pretend I'm scratching the skin."
"Does that help?"
"No," he said. "It doesn't help. But listen, Danny."
"Yes, Dad?"
"I want to tell you something." He started scratching away again at the plaster on his leg. I waited for him to go on. "I want to tell you what I would dearly love to do right now." Here it comes. I thought, here comes something big and crazy. I could always tell something big and crazy was coming simply from watching his face. "It's a deadly secret, Danny." He paused and looked carefully all around him.
and although there was probably not a living person within 2 miles of us at that moment, he now leaned close to me and lowered his voice to a soft whisper. "I would like," he whispered, "to find a way of poaching so many pheasants from Hazel's wood that there wouldn't be any left for the big opening day shoot on October the 1st.
"Dad!" I cried. "No!"
"Shh," he said. "Listen. If only I could find a way of knocking off a couple of hundred birds all in one go, then Mr. Hazel's party would be the biggest washout in history."
200, I said. "That's impossible."
"Just imagine, Danny," he went on, "what a triumph, what a glorious victory that would be. All the dukes and lords and famous men would arrive in their big cars, and Mr. Hazel would strut about like a peacock, welcoming them and saying things like, 'Plenty of birds out there for you this year, Lord Thistlethwaite,' and, 'Ah, my dear Sir Godfrey, this is a great season for pheasants, a very great season indeed.' And then out they would go, with their guns under their arms, and they would take up their positions surrounding the famous wood. And inside the wood, a whole army of hired beaters would start shouting and yelling and bashing away at the undergrowth to drive the pheasants out of the wood towards the waiting guns. And lo and behold, there wouldn't be a single pheasant to be found anywhere. And Mr. Victor Hazel's face would be redder than a boiled beetroot. Now, wouldn't that be the most fantastic, marvellous thing if we could pull it off, Danny?" My father had got himself so worked up that he rose to his feet and hobbled down the caravan steps and started pacing back and forth in front of me.
"Wouldn't it, though?" he shouted. "Wouldn't it be terrific?"
"Yes," I said.
"But how?" he cried. "How could it be done?"
"There's no way, Dad. It's hard enough getting just 2 birds up in those woods, let alone 200.
"I know that," my father said. "It's the keepers that make it so difficult."
"How many are there?" I asked.
"Keepers?" 3. "And they're always around."
"Do they stay right through the night?"
"No, not through the night," my father said. "They go off home as soon as all the pheasants are safely up in the trees, roosting.
But nobody's ever discovered a way of poaching a roosting pheasant. Not even my own dad, who was the greatest expert in the world."
"It's about your bedtime," he added. "Off you go, and I'll come in and tell you a story."
Chapter 11. The Sleeping Beauty. 5 minutes later, I was lying on my bunk in my pajamas. My father came in and lit the oil lamp hanging from the ceiling. It was getting dark earlier now.
"All right," he said. "What sort of story shall we have tonight?"
"Dad," I said, "wait a minute."
"What is it?"
"Can I ask you something? I've just had a bit of an idea."
"Go on," he said.
"You know that bottle of sleeping pills Doc Spencer gave you when you came back from hospital?"
"I never use them. Don't like the things."
"Yes, but is there any reason why those wouldn't work on a pheasant?"
My father shook his head sadly from side to side.
"Wait,"
I said. "It's no use, Danny. No pheasant in the world is going to swallow those lousy red capsules. Surely you know that."
"You're forgetting the raisins, Dad."
"The raisins? What's that got to do with it?"
"Now listen," I said. "Please listen. We take a raisin, we soak it till it swells, then we make a tiny slit in one side of it with a razor blade. Then we hollow it out a little, then we open up one of your red capsules and pour all the powder into the raisin. Then we get a needle and thread, and very carefully we sew up the slit."
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw my father's mouth slowly beginning to open.
"Now," I said, "we have a nice clean-looking raisin chock full of sleeping pill powder. and that ought to be enough to put any pheasant to sleep. Don't you think so?
My father was staring at me with a look of such wonder in his eyes, he might have been seeing a vision.
Oh, my darling boy, he said softly. Oh, my sainted aunt, I do believe you've got it. Yes, I do. I do. I do.
He was suddenly so choked up with excitement that for a few seconds he couldn't say any more. He came and sat on the edge of my bunk, and there he stayed, nodding his head very slowly up and down.
You really think it would work? I asked him.
Yes, he said quietly. It'll work all right. With this method, we could prepare 200 raisins, and all we'd have to do is scatter them round the feeding grounds at sunset, and then walk away. Half an hour later, after it was dark and the keepers had all gone home, we would go back into the wood, and the pheasants would be up in the trees by then, roosting, and the pills would be beginning to work, and the pheasants would be starting to feel groggy. They'd be wobbling and trying to keep their balance, and soon every pheasant that had eaten one single raisin would topple over unconscious and fall to the ground. Why, they'd be dropping out of the trees like apples, and all we'd have to do is walk around picking them up.
Can I do it with you, Dad?
And they'd never catch us either, my father said, not hearing me. We'd simply stroll through the woods, dropping a few raisins here and there as we went. And even if they were watching us, they wouldn't notice anything.
Dad, I said, raising my voice, you will let me come with you.
Danny, my love, he said, laying a hand on my knee and gazing at me with eyes large and bright as two stars. If this thing works, it will revolutionize poaching.
Yes, Dad, but can I come with you?
Come with me, he said, floating out of his dream at last. But my dear boy, of course you can come with me. It's your idea. You must be there to see it happening. Now then, he cried, bouncing up off the bed, where are those pills?
A small bottle of red capsules was standing beside the sink. It had been there ever since my father returned from hospital. He fetched it and unscrewed the top and poured the capsules onto my blanket.
Let's count them, he said.
We counted them together. There were exactly 50.
That's not enough, he said. We need 200 at least.
Then he cried out,
wait! Hold it! There's no problem.
He began carefully putting the capsules back into the bottle. And as he did so, he said, all we've got to do, Danny, is divide the powder from one capsule among four raisins. In other words, quarter the dose. That way, we would have enough to fill 200 raisins.
But would a quarter of one of those pills be strong enough to put a pheasant to sleep? I asked.
Of course it would, my dear boy.
Work it out for yourself. How much smaller is a pheasant than a man?
Many, many times smaller.
There you are, then. If one pill is enough to put a fully grown man to sleep, you'll only need a tiny bit of that for a pheasant. What we're giving him will knock the old pheasant for a loop.
He won't know what's hit him. But, Dad, 200 raisins aren't going to get you 200 pheasants.
Why not?
Because the greediest birds are surely going to gobble up about 10 raisins each.
You've got a point there, my father said. You certainly have.
But somehow, I don't think it will happen that way. Not if I am very careful and spread them out over a wide area.
Don't worry about it, Danny. I'm sure I can work it.
And you promise I can come with you?
Absolutely, he said. And we shall call this method the Sleeping Beauty. It will be a landmark in the history of poaching.
I sat very still in my bunk, watching my father as he put each capsule back into the bottle. I could hardly believe what was happening, that we were really going to do it, that he and I alone were going to try to swipe practically the entire flock of Mr. Victor Hazel's prize pheasants.
Just thinking about it sent little shivers of electricity running all over my skin.
Exciting, isn't it? My father said.
I don't dare think about it, Dad. It makes me shiver all over.
Me too, he said. But we must keep very calm from now on. We must make our plans very, very carefully. Today is Wednesday. The shooting party is next Saturday.
Cripes, I said. That's in 3 days' time. When do you and I go up to the wood and do the job?
The night before, my father said, on the Friday. In that way, they won't discover that all the pheasants have disappeared until it's too late and the party has begun.
Friday's the day after tomorrow. My goodness, Dad, we'll have to hurry if we're going to get 200 raisins ready before then.
My father stood up and began pacing the floor of the caravan. Here's the plan of action, he said. Listen carefully. Tomorrow is Thursday. When I walk you to school, I shall go into Cooper's stores in the village and buy 2 packets of seedless raisins, and in the evening we will put the raisins in to soak for the night.
But that only gives us Friday to get ready 200 raisins, I said. Each one will have to be cut open and filled with powder and sewed up again, and I'll be at school all day.
No, you won't, my father said. You will be suffering from a very nasty cold on Friday, and I shall be forced to keep you home from school.
Hooray! I said.
We will not open the filling station at all on Friday, he went on. Instead, we will shut ourselves in here and prepare the raisins. We'll easily get them done between us in 1 day. And that evening, off we'll go up the road towards the wood to do the job. Is that all clear?
He was like a general announcing the plan of battle to his staff. All clear, I said.
And Danny, not a whisper of this to any of your friends at school.
Dad, you know I wouldn't.
He kissed me good night and turned the oil lamp down low. But it was a long time before I went to sleep.
Chapter 12. Thursday and School. The next day was Thursday, and before we set out for the walk to my school that morning, I went around behind the caravan and picked 2 apples from our tree, one for my father and one for me. It is a most marvelous thing to be able to go out and help yourself to your own apples whenever you feel like it. You can do this only in the autumn, of course, when the fruit is ripe, but all the same, how many families are so lucky? Not 1 in 1,000, I would guess. Our apples were called Cox's Orange Pippins, and I liked the sound of the name almost as much as I liked the apples. At 8 o'clock, we started walking down the road towards my school in the pale autumn sunshine, munching our apples as we strode along. Clink went my father's iron foot each time he put it down on the hard road. Clink, clink, clink.
Have you brought money to buy the raisins? I asked.
He put a hand in his trouser pocket and made the coins jingle.
Will Cooper's be open so early?
Yes, he said. They open at 8:30. I really loved those morning walks to school with my father. We talked practically the whole time. Mostly it was he who talked and I who listened, and just about everything he said was fascinating. He was a true countryman. The fields, the streams, the woods, and all the creatures who lived in these places were a part of his life. Although he was a mechanic by trade, and a very fine one, I believe he could have become a great naturalist if only he had had a good schooling. Long ago, he had taught me the names of all the trees and the wild flowers and the different grasses that grow in the fields. All the birds, too, I could name, not only by sighting them, but by listening to their calls and their songs. In springtime, we would hunt for birds' nests along the way, and when we found one, he would lift me up onto his shoulders so I could peer into it and see the eggs, but I was never allowed to touch them. My father told me a nest with eggs in it was one of the most beautiful things in the world.
I thought so too. The nest of a song thrush, for instance, lined inside with dry mud as smooth as polished wood, and with 5 eggs of the purest blue speckled with black dots. And the skylark, whose nest we once found right in the middle of a field, in a grassy clump on the ground. It was hardly a nest at all, just a little hollow place in the grass, and in it were 6 small eggs, deep brown and white. "Why does the skylark make its nest on the ground, where the cows can trample it?" I asked. "Nobody knows why," my father said. "But they always do it. Nightingales nest on the ground too. So do pheasants and partridges and grouse." On one of our walks, a weasel flashed out of the hedge in front of us, and in the next few minutes I learned a lot of things about that marvellous little creature. The bit I liked best was when my father said, "The weasel is the bravest of all animals. The mother will fight to the death to defend her own children. She will never run away, not even from a fox, which is 100 times bigger than her. She will stay beside her nest and fight the fox until she is killed." Another time, when I said, "Just listen to that grasshopper, Dad," he said, "No, that's not a grasshopper, my love. It's a cricket. And did you know that crickets have their ears in their legs?" "It's not true." "It's absolutely true. And grasshoppers have theirs in the sides of their tummies. They're lucky to be able to hear at all, because nearly all the vast hordes of insects on this earth are deaf as well as dumb, and live in a silent world." On this Thursday, on this particular walk to school, there was an old frog croaking in the stream behind the hedge as we went by. "Can you hear him, Danny?"
"Yes," I said.
"That is a bullfrog calling to his wife. He does it by blowing out his dewlap and letting it go with a burp."
"What is a dewlap?" I asked.
"It's the loose skin on his throat. He can blow it up just like a little balloon."
"What happens when his wife hears him?"
"She goes hopping over to him. She is very happy to have been invited. But I'll tell you something very funny about the old bullfrog. He often becomes so pleased with the sound of his own voice that his wife has to nudge him several times before he'll stop his burping and turn round to hug her." That made me laugh. "Don't laugh too loud," he said, twinkling at me with his eyes. "We men are not so very different from the bullfrog." We parted at the school gates, and my father went off to buy the raisins. Other children were streaming in through the gates and heading up the path to the front door of the school. I joined them, but kept silent. I was the keeper of a deep secret, and a careless word from me could blow the lid off the greatest poaching expedition the world would ever see. Ours was just a small village school, a squat, ugly, red-brick building with no upstairs rooms at all. Above the front door was a big grey block of stone, cemented into the brickwork, and on the stone it said, "This school was erected in 1902 to commemorate the coronation of His Royal Highness King Edward VII. I must have read that thing 1,000 times. Every time I went in the door, it hit me in the eye. I suppose that's what it was there for. But it's pretty boring to read the same old words over and over again. And I often thought how nice it would be if they put something different up there every day, something really interesting. My father would have done it for them beautifully. He could have written it with a bit of chalk on the smooth grey stone, and each morning it would have been something new. He would have said things like, 'Did you know that the little yellow clover butterfly often carries his wife around on his back?' Another time he might have said, 'The guppy has funny habits. When he falls in love with another guppy, he bites her on the bottom.' And another time, 'Did you know that the death's head moth can squeak?' And then again, 'Birds have almost no sense of smell, but they have good eyesight and they love red colours. The flowers they like are red and yellow, but never blue.' And perhaps another time he would get out his chalk and write, 'Some bees have tongues which they can unroll until they are nearly twice as long as the bee itself,
This is to allow them to gather nectar from flowers that have very long, narrow openings.
Or, he might have written, I'll bet you didn't know that in some big English country houses, the butler still has to iron the morning newspaper before putting it on his master's breakfast table.
There were about 60 boys and girls in our school, and their ages went from 5 to 11. We had 4 classrooms and 4 teachers. Miss Birdseye taught the kindergarten, the 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, and she was a really nice person. She used to keep a bag of aniseed balls in the drawer of her desk, and anyone who did good work would be given 1 aniseed ball to suck right there and then during the lesson. The trick with aniseed balls is never to bite them. If you keep rolling them round in your mouth, they will dissolve slowly of their own accord, and then, right in the very center, you will find a tiny little brown seed. This is the aniseed itself, and when you crush it between your teeth, it has a fabulous taste. My father told me that dogs go crazy about it. When there aren't any foxes around, the huntsman will drag a bag of aniseed for miles and miles over the countryside, and the foxhounds will follow the scent because they love it so. This is known as a drag hunt. The 7- and 8-year-olds were taught by Mr. Corrado, and he was also a decent person. He was a very old teacher, probably 60 or more, but that didn't seem to stop him being in love with Miss Birdseye. We knew he was in love with her, because he always gave her the best bits of meat at lunch when it was his turn to do the serving. And, when she smiled at him, he would smile back at her in the soppiest way you can imagine, showing all his front teeth, top and bottom, and most of the others as well. A teacher called Captain Lancaster took the 9- and 10-year-olds, and this year that included me. Captain Lancaster, known sometimes as Lankers, was a horrid man. He had fiery carrot-coloured hair, and a little clipped carroty moustache, and a fiery temper. Carroty-coloured hairs were also sprouting out of his nostrils and his ear holes. He had been a captain in the army during the war against Hitler, and that was why he still called himself Captain Lancaster instead of just plain Mister. My father said it was an idiotic thing to do. There were millions of people still alive, he said, who had fought in that war, but most of them wanted to forget the whole beastly thing, especially those crummy military titles. Captain Lancaster was a violent man, and we were all terrified of him. He used to sit at his desk, stroking his carroty moustache, and watching us with pale, watery blue eyes, searching for trouble. And, as he sat there, he would make queer, snuffling grunts through his nose, like some dog sniffing round a rabbit hole. Mr. Snoddy, our headmaster, took the top form, the 11-year-olds, and everybody liked him. He was a small, round man with a huge scarlet nose. I felt sorry for him having a nose like that. It was so big and inflamed, it looked as though it might explode at any moment and blow him up. A funny thing about Mr. Snoddy was that he always brought a glass of water with him into class, and this he kept sipping right through the lesson. At least everyone thought it was a glass of water. Everyone, that is, except me and my best friend, Sidney Morgan. We knew differently, and this is how we found out. My father looked after Mr. Snoddy's car, and I always took his repair bills with me to school to save postage. One day, during break, I went to Mr. Snoddy's study to give him a bill, and Sidney Morgan came along with me. He didn't come for any special reason. We just happened to be together at the time. And, as we went in, we saw Mr. Snoddy standing by his desk, refilling his famous glass of water from a bottle labelled Gordon's Gin. He jumped a mile when he saw us.
"You should have knocked," he said, sliding the bottle behind a pile of books.
"I'm sorry, sir," I said. "I brought my father's bill."
"Ah," he said. "Yes, yes, very well. And what do you want, Sidney?"
"Nothing, sir," Sidney Morgan said. "Nothing at all."
"Off you go, then, both of you,"
Mr. Snoddy said, keeping his hand on the bottle behind the books.
Run along.
Outside in the corridor, we made a pact that we wouldn't tell any of the other children about what we had seen. Mr. Snoddy had always been kind to us, and we wanted to repay him by keeping his deep, dark secret to ourselves. The only person I told was my father, and when he heard it, he said,
I don't blame him one bit. If I was unlucky enough to be married to Mrs. Snoddy, I would drink something a bit stronger than gin.
What would you drink, Dad?
Poison, he said. She's a frightful woman.
Why is she frightful? I asked.
She's a sort of witch, he said. And to prove it, she has 7 toes on each foot.
How do you know that? I asked.
Doc Spencer told me, my father answered.
And then, to change the subject, he said,
Why don't you ever ask Sidney Morgan over here to play?
Ever since I started going to school, my father had tried to encourage me to bring my friends back to the filling station for tea or supper. And every year, about a week before my birthday, he would say,
Let's have a party this time, Danny. We can write out invitations, and I'll go into the village and buy chocolate eclairs and doughnuts and a huge birthday cake with candles on it.
But I always said no to these suggestions, and I never invited any other children to come to my home after school or at weekends. That wasn't because I didn't have good friends. I had lots of them. Some of them were super friends, especially Sidney Morgan. Perhaps if I had lived in the same street as some of them instead of way out in the country, things would have been different. But then again, perhaps they wouldn't. You see, the real reason I didn't want anyone else to come back and play with me was because I had such a good time being alone with my father. By the way, something horrible happened on that Thursday morning after my father had left me at the school gate and gone off to buy the raisins. We were having our first lesson of the day with Captain Lancaster, and he had set us a whole bunch of multiplication sums to work out in our exercise books. I was sitting next to Sidney Morgan in the back row, and we were both slogging away. Captain Lancaster sat up front at his desk, gazing suspiciously round the class with his watery blue eyes. And even from the back row, I could hear him snorting and snuffling through his nose like a dog outside a rabbit hole. Sidney Morgan covered his mouth with his hand and whispered very softly to me,
What are 8 9s? 72, I whispered back.
Captain Lancaster's finger shot out like a bullet and pointed straight at my face.
You! He shouted. Stand up!
Me, sir, I said.
Yes, you, you blithering little idiot!
I stood up.
You were talking, he barked. What were you saying?
He was shouting at me as though I was a platoon of soldiers on the parade ground.
Come on, boy! Out with it!
I stood still and said nothing.
Are you refusing to answer me? He shouted.
Please, sir, Sidney said. It was my fault. I asked him a question.
Oh, you did you? Stand up!
Sidney stood up beside me.
And what exactly did you ask him?
Captain Lancaster said, speaking more quietly now and far more dangerously.
I asked him what are 8 9s, Sidney said.
And I suppose you answered him, Captain Lancaster said, pointing at me again.
He never called any of us by our names. It was always you, or boy, or girl, or something like that.
Did you answer him, or didn't you?
Speak up, boy!
Yes, sir, I did.
So, you were cheating, he said. Both of you were cheating.
We kept silent.
Cheating is a repulsive habit practiced by gutter snipes and dandyprats, he said.
From where I was standing, I could see the whole class sitting absolutely rigid watching Captain Lancaster. Nobody dared move.
You may be permitted to cheat and lie and swindle in your own homes, he went on, but I will not put up with it here.
At this point,
A sort of blind fury took hold of me, and I shouted back at him, "I am not a cheat!"
There was a fearful silence in the room. Captain Lancaster raised his chin and fixed me with his watery eyes.
"You are not only a cheat, but you are insolent," he said quietly. "You are a very insolent boy. Come up here, both of you. Come up here."
As I stepped out from my desk and began walking up towards the front of the class, I knew exactly what was going to happen. I'd seen it happen to others many times, to both boys and girls. But up until now, it had never happened to me. Each time I had seen it, it had made me feel quite sick inside. Captain Lancaster was standing up and crossing over to the tall bookcase that stood against the left-hand wall of the classroom. He reached up to the topmost shelf of the bookcase and brought down the dreaded cane. It was white, this cane, as white as bone, and very long and very thin, with one end bent over into a handle like a walking stick.
"You first," he said, pointing at me with the cane. "Hold out your left hand."
It was almost impossible to believe that this man was about to injure me physically and in cold blood. As I lifted my left-hand palm upwards and held it there, I looked at the palm itself and the pink skin and the fortune-teller's lines running over it, and I still could not bring myself to imagine that anything was going to happen to it. The long white cane went up high in the air and came down on my hand with a crack like a rifle going off. I heard the crack first, and about 2 seconds later, I felt the pain. Never had I felt a pain such as that in my whole life. It was as though someone were pressing a red-hot poker against my palm and holding it there. I remember grabbing my injured left hand with my right hand and ramming it between my legs and squeezing my legs together against it. I squeezed and squeezed as hard as I could, as if I were trying to stop the hand from falling to pieces. I managed not to cry out loud, but I couldn't keep the tears from pouring down my cheeks. From somewhere nearby, I heard another fearful swish crack, and I knew that poor Sydney had just got it as well. But oh, that fearful searing burning pain across my hand. Why didn't it go away? I glanced at Sydney. He was doing just the same as me, squeezing his hand between his legs and making the most awful face.
"Go and sit down, both of you,"
Captain Lancaster ordered. We stumbled back to our desks and sat down.
"Now get on with your work," the dreaded voice said, "and let us have no more cheating, no more insolence either."
The class bent their heads over their books, like people in church saying their prayers. I looked at my hand. There was a long, ugly mark, about half an inch wide, running right across the palm, just where the fingers joined the hand. It was raised up in the middle, and the raised part was pure white, with red on both sides. I moved the fingers. They moved all right, but it hurt to move them. I looked at Sydney. He gave me a quick, apologetic glance under his eyelids, then went back to his sums. When I got home from school that afternoon, my father was in the workshop. "I've bought the raisins," he said. "We will now put them into soak. Fetch me a bowl of water, Denny." I went over to the caravan and got a bowl and half filled it with water. I carried it to the workshop and put it on the bench. "Open up the packets and tip them all in," my father said. This was one of the really nice things about my father. He didn't take over and want to do everything himself. Whether it was a difficult job like adjusting a carburetor in a big engine, or whether it was simply tipping some raisins into a basin, he always let me go ahead and do it myself while he watched and stood ready to help. He was watching me now as I opened the first packet of raisins. "Hey!" he cried, grabbing my left wrist. "What's happened to your hand?"
"It's nothing," I said, clenching the fist.
He made me open it up. The long scarlet mark lay across my palm like a burn.
"Who did it?" he shouted.
Was it Captain Lancaster?
Yes, Dad, but it's nothing.
What happened?
He was gripping my wrist so hard it almost hurt. Tell me exactly what happened. I told him everything. He stood there, holding my wrist, his face going whiter and whiter, and I could see the fury beginning to boil up dangerously inside him.
I'll kill him, he softly whispered when I had finished. I swear I'll kill him.
His eyes were blazing, and all the color had gone from his face. I'd never seen him look like that before.
Forget it, Dad.
I will not forget it, he said. You did nothing wrong, and he had absolutely no right to do this to you.
So he called you a cheat, did he? I nodded. He had taken his jacket from the peg on the wall and was putting it on.
Where are you going? I asked.
I am going straight to Captain Lancaster's house, and I'm going to beat the daylights out of him.
No! I cried, catching hold of his arm. Don't do it, Dad, please. It won't do any good. Please don't do it.
I've got to, he said.
No,
I cried, tugging at his arm.
It'll ruin everything. It'll only make it worse. Please forget it.
He hesitated then. I held on to his arm. He was silent, and I could see the rush of anger slowly draining out of his face.
It's revolting, he said.
I'll bet they did it to you when you were at school. I said.
Of course they did.
And I'll bet your dad didn't go rushing off to beat the daylights out of the teacher who did it.
He looked at me, but kept quiet.
He didn't, did he, Dad?
No, Danny, he didn't, he answered softly.
I let go of his arm and helped him off with his jacket and hung it back on the peg. I'm going to put the raisins in now, I said. And don't forget that tomorrow I have a nasty cold and I won't be going to school.
Yes, he said. That's right.
We've got 200 raisins to fill, I said.
Ah, he said. So we have.
I hope we'll get them done in time, I said.
Does it still hurt? He asked. That hand.
No, I said. Not one bit.
I think that satisfied him.
And although I saw him glancing occasionally at my palm during the rest of the afternoon and evening, he never mentioned the subject again. That night, he didn't tell me a story. He sat on the edge of my bunk, and we talked about what was going to happen the next day up in Hazel's Wood. He got me so steamed up and excited about it, I couldn't get to sleep. I think he must have got himself steamed up almost as much, because after he had undressed and climbed into his own bunk, I heard him twisting and turning all over the place. He couldn't get to sleep either. At about 10:30, he climbed out of his bunk and put the kettle on.
What's the matter, Dad?
Nothing, he said. Shall we have a midnight feast?
Yes, let's do that.
He lit the lamp in the ceiling and opened a tin of tuna and made a delicious sandwich for each of us. Also, hot chocolate for me and tea for him. Then we started talking about the pheasants and about Hazel's Wood all over again. It was pretty late before we got to sleep.
Chapter 13. Friday. When my father woke me at 6 o'clock next morning, I knew at once that this was the day of days. It was the day I longed for, and the day I dreaded. It was also the day of butterflies in the stomach, except that they were worse than butterflies. They were snakes. I had snakes in the stomach the moment I opened my eyes on that Friday morning. The first thing I did after I had got dressed was to hang the "sorry closed" notice on one of the pumps. We had a quick breakfast. Then the two of us sat down together at the table in the caravan to prepare the raisins. They were plump and soft and swollen from being soaked in water, and when you nicked them with a razor blade, the skin sprang open and the jelly stuff inside squeezed out as easily as you could wish. I slit the raisins while my father opened the capsules. He opened only one at a time and poured the white powder onto a piece of paper.
Then he divided it into four tiny piles with the blade of a knife. Each pile was carefully scooped up and put into a single raisin. A needle and black cotton finished the job. The sewing up was the hardest part, and my father did most of that. It took about 2 minutes to do one raisin from start to finish. I enjoyed it. It was fun.
"Your mother was wonderful at sewing things," my father said. "She'd have had these raisins done in no time."
I didn't say anything. I never knew quite what to say when he talked about my mother.
"Did you know? She used to make all my clothes herself, Danny. Everything I wore."
"Even socks and sweaters?" I asked.
"Yes," he said. "But those were knitted, and so quickly. When she was knitting, the needles flew so fast in her fingers, you couldn't see them. They were just a blur. I would sit here in the evening watching her, and she used to talk about the children she was going to have. 'I shall have 3 children,' she used to say. 'A boy for you, a girl for me, and one for good measure.'"
There was a short silence after that. Then I said, "When Mum was here, Dad, did you go out very often at night, or was it only now and then?"
"You mean poaching?"
"Yes."
"Often," he said. "At least twice a week."
"Didn't she mind?"
"Mind? Of course she didn't mind.
She came with me."
"She didn't." "She certainly did.
She came with me every single time until just before you were born. She had to stop then. She said she couldn't run fast enough."
I thought about this extraordinary piece of news for a little while. Then I said,
"Was the only reason she went because she loved you, Dad, and because she wanted to be with you? Or did she go because she loved poaching?"
"Both," my father said. "She did it for both the reasons you mentioned." I was beginning to realize what an immense sorrow it must have been to him when she died.
"Weren't you afraid she might get shot up?" I asked.
"Yes, Danny, I was. But it was marvelous to have her along. She was a great sport, your mother."
By midday, we had prepared 136 raisins.
"We're in good shape," my father said. "Let's break for lunch."
He opened a tin of baked beans and heated them up in a saucepan over the paraffin burner. I cut 2 slices of brown bread and put them on plates. My father spooned the hot baked beans over the bread, and we carried our plates outside and sat down with our legs dangling over the platform of the caravan. Usually, I love baked beans on bread, but today I couldn't eat a thing.
"What's the matter?" my father asked.
"I'm not hungry."
"Don't worry," he said. "The same thing happened to me the first time I went out. I was about your age then, maybe a little older. And in those days we always had a hot tea in the kitchen at 5 o'clock. I can remember exactly what was on the table that evening. It was my favourite thing of all, toad in the hole. And my mum could make toad in the hole like nobody else in the world. She did it in an enormous pan with the Yorkshire pudding very brown and crisp on top and raised up in huge bubbly mountains. In between the mountains, you could see the sausages half buried in the batter. Fantastic it was. But on that day, my stomach was so jumpy, I couldn't eat one mouthful. I expect yours feels like that now."
"Mine's full of snakes," I said. "They won't stop wiggling about."
"Mine doesn't feel exactly normal either," my father said. "But then, this isn't a normal operation, is it?"
"No, Dad, it's not."
"Do you know what this is, Danny?" "This is the most colossal and extraordinary poaching job anyone has ever been on in the history of the world."
"Don't go on about it, Dad. It only makes me more jumpy. What time do we leave here?"
"I've worked that out," he said. "We must enter the wood about 15 minutes before sunset. If we arrive after sunset, all the pheasants will have flown up to roost, and it'll be too late."
"When is sunset?" I asked.
"Right now it's about 7:30, he said. "So we must arrive at 7:15 exactly.
It's an hour and a half's walk to the wood, so we must leave here at 5:45.
Then we better finish those raisins, I said. We've still got more than 60 to do.
We finished the raisins with about 2 hours to spare. They lay in a pile on a white plate in the middle of the table. Don't they look marvellous, my father said, rubbing his hands together hard. Those pheasants are going to absolutely love them. After that, we messed round in the workshop until 5:30. Then my father said, That's it. It's time to get ready. We leave in 15 minutes. As we walked towards the caravan, a station wagon pulled up to the pumps, with a woman at the wheel and about 8 children in the back, all eating ice creams.
Oh, I know you're closed, the woman called out through her window, but couldn't you please let me have a few gallons? I'm just about empty.
She was a good-looking woman with dark hair. Give it to her, my father said, but be quick. I fetched the key from the office and unlocked one of the pumps. I filled up her tank and took the money and gave her the change.
You don't usually close as early as this, she said.
We have to go out, I told her, hopping from one foot to the other. I have to go somewhere with my father.
You look jumpy as a jackrabbit, she said. Is it the dentist?
No, Mum, I said. It's not the dentist. But please excuse me. I have to go now.
Chapter 14 Into the Wood. My father came out of the caravan wearing the old navy blue sweater and the brown cloth cap with the peak pulled down low over his eyes.
What's under there, Dad?
I asked, seeing the bulge at his waistline. He pulled up his sweater and showed me 2 thin but very large white cotton sacks. They were bound neat and tidy round his belly. To carry the stuff, he said darkly.
Aha!
Go and put on your sweater, he said. It's brown, isn't it?
Yes, I said.
That'll do. But take off those white sneakers and wear your black shoes instead. I went into the caravan and changed my shoes and put on my sweater. When I came out again, my father was standing by the pumps, squinting anxiously up at the sun, which was now only the width of a man's hand above the line of trees along the crest of the ridge on the far side of the valley.
I'm ready, Dad.
Good boy. Off we go.
Have you got the raisins? I asked.
In here, he said, tapping his trouser pocket where yet another bulge was showing. I've put them all in one bag. It was a calm, sunny evening, with little wisps of brilliant white cloud hanging motionless in the sky, and the valley was cool and very quiet as the two of us began walking together along the road that ran between the hills towards Wendover. The iron thing underneath my father's foot made a noise like a hammer striking a nail each time it hit the road. "This is it, Danny. We're on our way now," he said. By golly, I wish my old dad were coming with us on this one. He'd have given his right teeth to be here at this moment.
Mum, too, I said.
Ah, yes, he said, giving a little sigh. Your mother would have loved this one. Then he said, Your mother was a great one for walking, Danny, and she would always bring something home with her to brighten up the caravan. In summer, it was wild flowers or grasses. When the grass was in seed, she could make it look absolutely beautiful in a jug of water, especially with some stalks of wheat or barley in between. In the autumn, she would pick branches of leaves, and in the winter, it was berries or old man's beard. We kept going. Then he said, How do you feel, Danny?
Terrific, I said,
and I meant it. For although the snakes were still wiggling in my stomach, I wouldn't have swapped places with the King of Arabia at that moment.
Do you think they might have dug any more of those pits for us to fall into? I asked.
Don't you go worrying about pits, Danny, my father said. I'll be on the lookout for them this time. We shall go very carefully and very slowly once we're in the wood.
How dark will it be in there when we arrive?
Not too dark, he said. Quite light, in fact.
Then how do we stop the keepers from seeing us?
Ah, he said. That's the fun of the whole thing. That's what it's all about. It's hide and seek. It's the greatest game of hide and seek in the world.
You mean because they've got guns?
Well, he said, that does add a bit of flavor to it, yes. We didn't talk much after that. But as we got closer and closer to the wood, I could see my father becoming more and more twitchy as the excitement began to build up in him. He would get hold of some awful old tune, and instead of using the words, he would go, tum tiddly yum tum 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 tum, over and over again. Then he would get hold of another tune and go, pom piddly pom pom om pom pom, pom piddly om, pom piddly om. As he sang, he tried to keep time with the tap-tap of his iron foot on the roadway. When he got tired of that, he said to me, I'll tell you something interesting about pheasants, Danny. The law says they're wild birds, so they only belong to you when they're on your own land. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, Dad.
So, if one of Mr. Hazel's pheasants flew over and perched on our filling station, he said, it would belong to us. No one else would be allowed to touch it.
You mean, even if Mr. Hazel had bought it himself as a chick, I said.
Even if he had bought it and reared it in his own wood. Absolutely, my father said. Once it flies off his own land, he's lost it. Unless, of course, it flies back again. It's the same with fish. Once a trout or a salmon has swum out of your stretch of the river into somebody else's, you can't very well say, hey, that's mine, I want it back, can you?
Of course not, I said. But I didn't know it was like that with pheasants.
It's the same with all game, my father said. Hare, deer, partridge, grouse, you name it. We had been walking steadily for about an hour and a quarter, and we were coming to the gap in the hedge where the cart track led up the hill to the big wood where the pheasants lived. We crossed over the road and went through the gap. We walked on up the cart track, and when we reached the crest of the hill, we could see the wood ahead of us, huge and dark, with the sun going down behind the trees and little sparks of gold shining through. No talking, Danny, once we're inside, my father said. Keep very close to me, and try not to go snapping any branches. 5 minutes later, we were there. The wood skirted the edge of the track on the right-hand side, with only the hedge between it and us. Come on, my father said. In we go. He slipped through the hedge on all fours, and I followed. It was cool and murky inside the wood. No sunlight came in at all. My father took me by the hand, and together we started walking forward between the trees. I was very grateful to him for holding my hand. I had wanted to take hold of his the moment we entered the wood, but I thought he might disapprove. My father was very tense. He was picking his feet up high and putting them down gently on the brown leaves. He kept his head moving all the time, the eyes sweeping slowly from side to side, searching for danger. I tried doing the same, but soon I began to see a keeper behind every tree, so I gave it up. We went on like this for maybe 4 or 5 minutes, going slowly deeper and deeper into the wood. Then a large patch of sky appeared ahead of us in the roof of the forest, and I knew that this must be the clearing. My father had told me that the clearing was the place where the young birds were introduced into the wood in early July, where they were fed and watered and guarded by the keepers, and where many of them stayed from force of habit until the shooting began. There's always plenty of pheasants in the clearing, my father had said.
And keepers, Dad?
Yes, he had said. But there's thick bushes all around, and that helps. The clearing was about 100 yards ahead of us. We stopped behind a big tree, while my father let his eyes travel very slowly all round. He was checking each little shadow and every part of the wood within sight.
We're going to have to crawl the next bit, he whispered, letting go of my hand. Keep close behind me all the time, Danny, and do exactly as I do. If you see me lie flat on my face, you do the same. Right?
Right,
I whispered back. Off we go, then. This is it.
My father got down on his hands and knees and started